Welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 341. That's the next one after 340, which was last week, about telepathic communication. Very huge topic. Today, it's Friday the 5th or 6th of November, the day after Election Day, or the Super Bowl, whatever you want to call it. And it just seems so clearly orchestrated and created as a media event, regardless of what it is actually supposed to mean. Anyway, I'm seated here in the beautiful Darwin Botanical Garden, where I was blessed to be able to sit here, well, a couple hundred meters away at Eva's Cafe 3 years ago for several weeks and paint outdoors in my most awesome art studio ever. So I've come back today and I'm sitting beneath a beautiful boab tree. I'm not in the actual Madagascar boab garden, which is about a couple hundred meters from me, but this is a grassy area surrounded by flowers, and there's this one beautiful boab tree that I'm sitting right in front of, and there's a nice wooden bench, and I'm kind of in the shadow of the tree with the sun going down, and there's a bit of wind. You might pick up some of that on the microphone here, but it seemed like the perfect place to record my show today that's addressing a concept, an issue, an idea, a belief, a terminology, a label, a word that I use a lot in my own life and in my On the Brink broadcasts and posts, and it's the word indigenous. And what I'd like to do in this show is to look at what that word means, what we mean when we use it, and having established that, or at least evaluated that, consider if it's actually possible for there to be any truly indigenous people left on Mother Earth today, and through no doing of their own. But, and then this also ties in with what it's in contrast to. So I think probably part of what's really brought me to examine what indigenous means is my examination of what civilized means. And you know from the countless times I've talked about it on the show that the word civilized comes from the Latin word civitas. That's civitas. It's where civic and civil comes from. But it means living in cities. That's what civilized means. And etymologically, that's all it means. So it's taken on the connotation of meaning, oh, well, civilized behavior means it's not what would be uncivilized behavior, barbaric, murderous, heathen, eating with your fingers and wiping on your pants and that kind of thing. We think civilized means that you're very courteous and polite and thoughtful, and that you spend a lot of time sitting in gardens, which I must be civilized right now because I'm sitting in a very beautiful garden. Sipping tea, going to art galleries, maybe riding your horses or walking your dog, or maybe, see, now a lot of people would think, I mean, you know, you think of, my mind goes to England, jolly old England, when I think of civilized behavior, and even people go like, well, is it civilized to hunt Aboriginal people in Tasmania? Or is it civilized to hunt foxes with all our dogs? Or, I mean, you see where I'm going with this. So it's like, but really all it means is living in cities, and that all the heathen, heavy-duty, barbarian stuff you farm out to your slaves, your servants, your armies, your people that you pay to do all the stuff, like, it would be uncivilized to slaughter a cow, but you're glad to pay the butcher to do it. So it's all a bit sort of muddled when you actually start examining what it all means. But I've contrasted the basic concept of indigenous against the basic concept of civilized a lot of times. And in the context of looking at our friends and family, the whales and dolphins, and how they truly are people, they're just not human people. And also, and looking at what that word means. And so, but that's also equally important. People can be indigenous, they can be civilized. Is it possible to be both? Is it possible to have aspects of both? And I think, in a way, yes. And I think, in a way, that's, to varying degrees, that's what everybody, every human being alive on this planet right now, is, has some of both, to greater or lesser extremes. And I'm fairly much of a hybrid myself. But anyway, what do we mean by indigenous? The fundamental dictionary definition says something like, indigenous means somebody or something that's where they belong. It's that they're living in the place where they're from, where they originated. And so, could we say, life is indigenous to Earth? We could say that, but we don't know for sure that life is actually from here originally. But it's been here for a long time, so if it appears to have been from somewhere a long time, that's as good as saying that it's originally from there. So we can say that the black First Nations Australians, or what the Europeans call the Aboriginal people, which in itself is Latin, it means from the beginning, are they indigenous to Australia? And I would say, well, certainly yes. And even though, even if they knew, or we knew, or anybody discovered or determined that their ancestors came here from somewhere else, but that would be a long, long time ago. Long enough for it to mean that they're actually from here. They've been here for a long time. So, but as contrasted with the Maori people of New Zealand at Tiaroa, now would you say that they're indigenous to New Zealand? And you're looking at a completely different time frame. They'll tell you, and so will historians, that their earliest arrivals into New Zealand were only not much more than 1,000 years ago, which means that the indigenous people of Australia would have been living here at least 100 times longer than that without having come here from anywhere else. So the Maori, very recent arrivals there. But that 1,000 years seemed like a long time until the Europeans came in the, whenever it was, 14, 1500, something like that, Abel Tasman. And so, would you say the Maori are indigenous to New Zealand? And I'm not saying yes or no. I think a lot of people think they are. But then, now we start getting into another question here that relates to indigenous, because sometimes people think it has to do with what, I don't like to use the word race to talk about what someone's ethnic background is, because we're all the human race, I think, or at least we look like it. But once I had to fill out a bureaucratic form from an American law enforcement agency a few years ago, and on there it asked what race I was. And I started to write in human, except all it had was words that you had to check the box, and white was one of them. But if I could have, I would have written in human, and then I would have put skin color, beige with freckles, which is true. I'm not white. I've never seen a white person, and white is a sheet of paper or a fluffy cloud or some snow. Never seen a person that color. And how we even started using that word to describe ourselves is kind of a mystery to me. That's something to look into, the origins of the white man. So anyway, does indigenous have to do with what someone's ethnic background is? And of course, in Australia, like if there was somebody that was European that had been living here for 50,000 years, then of course they would be indigenous to here. But in the reality that we have now, the only people that have been here that long are the black Aboriginal people. And so we Europeans with the fair skin came from Central and Northern Europe. So does that mean that we're indigenous to there, but not to here? And so everybody, every life form has to have been indigenous from somewhere, because that's wherever they came from, that's where they're indigenous to. And so the Europeans have come to Australia, and the black people here, who are the true indigenous people, have been genocided down to a small fraction of their original numbers, and enslaved and desecrated and denuded of their language and their cultural abilities and their self-respect and everything. And now we've got, as opposed to at least probably 3 million or more people that lived here 200 years ago, now there's only, so they say, this is an old figure, several years old, that there's only 70 to 80,000 full-blooded indigenous Australians left, most of whom are up here in the top end in Arnhem Land, as contrasted with the Maori in New Zealand, where they say that now, as of even quite a few years ago, there are zero, that is zelch, none, 100% full-blooded Maori people left anywhere. We're talking about ethnic purity, whatever that means. I mean, does it even mean anything? It's a very sort of thing that's dwelt on a lot. It gets a lot of tension. It creates a lot of tension and gets a lot of attention. But that's partly why I'm doing this show, to look at all this stuff. So we've got, like here in Australia, I believe that in order to be legally classified as an Indigenous Australian, you have to be able to prove that you're at least 1/8 Aboriginal by birth. I think that means that genealogically one of your grandparents had to be a full-blooded Aboriginal person. I think it's something like that. I think it's 1/8, however they would come at that. And how that's different from a 16th or a 32nd or half or a 64th or a millionth or anything like that. You know, it's like we're talking genetics. We're not talking spirituality. We're not talking mentality. We're not talking the pragmatic aspects of how anybody lives, which that's what, to me, Indigenous really means. It has nothing to do with whether you're from here or not, how long you've lived here, who your ancestry is, what color your skin is, what your ethnic background is. It's none of those. It means, are you living as or as close to as possible in the true old school traditional ways that Indigenous people have lived in before the dawn of civilization? And of course, the specifics of this are going to vary from country to country, from culture to culture, from language group to language group. But the essence of it is that indigenous people live close to earth, to the earth, close to nature, close to each other with a sense of kinship and conscious acknowledgement and gratitude towards Mother Earth and our fellow life forms, and living simply and not obsessed with material possessions, if even having any. And this is why I put the whales and dolphins on the spectrum of indigenous people as them being the ultimate indigenous people, because they've got all the neurobiological heart and software that we have, only much more highly evolved, and they've had it much longer. But they live in the ocean, they don't have hands, and so they have spiritual and cultural dimensions to their living that may be similar to ours in some ways, but they don't have any of the material possessions. And then material cultures, for example, of at the level of the indigenous Australians, it was quite minimal. Like, they, as far as I know, they never even used metal, which some of the indigenous cultures in the Americas and Europe use metal. But the people here never did. They used stone and wood. And I think ultimately that's a much more highly evolved way to live. Because, I mean, if the whales and dolphins can live successfully for 10, 20, or 30 million years in perfect harmony with their environment without even having hands, why did we need them? I mean, it's possible to live on the land, I mean, without having hands. We're just about the only ones that do. I mean, other animals, like all your primates and your mammals, all your primates have hands that they use them in kind of hand-like ways. They may not have opposable thumbs, but they can grasp. Birds have little hands they can grasp food with. Lizards, reptiles, not sure about frogs. Insects have mandibles and pinchers they can grab things. So, but it's possible to live without having things that can grab and hold on. But where our whole intelligence and mode of being is very tightly wound up with grabbing and holding on to and getting. We use hands for getting stuff a lot. But I think that indigenous people, in general, the contents of their mind is nature. And maybe their own story, their own memories. And they live in a temporal continuum with their ancestors and the world around them in a constant communion or communication with all of our family of life. And I think all living beings have that sort of a holomorphic resonance that's going on all the time with different orders of information transfer, just like Jeremy Narby and Rupert Sheldrake talk about, who I mentioned in my show about telepathy last week. Since we've had civilization, which is founded on violating the fundamental premise of the Hopi prophecy, which is, if we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster. And quarrying out stone was probably the first thing that we dug out. Then maybe like diamonds and precious stones and things like that. And then, I'm not sure what would have come next, metals like tin or bronze, or the shiny ones like silver and platinum. Or then we would have found coal. And then came along hydrocarbons, and then uranium. And as we've lived in civilization for thousands and thousands of years, we've progressively become more domesticated, auto-domesticated, and mutating ourselves. We call it cultural evolution. But it's really more of a non physiological mutation. It's sort of a behavioral and psychic mutation that we subject ourselves to. And one of the things is that we've a big difference between indigenous. I don't think indigenous people have slaves or armies. They don't have the economic hierarchies or infrastructure that allows them to farm out the stuff they don't want to do to other people because they can pay them. They do it themselves, and they don't need. They don't have the imperative of doing a lot of unnecessary. They don't spend the vast majority of their waking life doing some kind of work just to make money that means nothing to them, that has no tangible, practical value in their day-to-day life. Yet that's what most people in modern society do with most of their time. It's their job to make money. And it's actually a form of insanity because money's not really real. And if most people were able to give an honest answer about whether what they do as a job, what they're committed to with their life, if it means enough that they would still do it, even if they didn't get paid for it, because they believe in it and it's important. How many people would say yes to that? Very, very, very few. Very few. Almost none. Almost none. Maybe some people that were maybe like school teachers and nurses, maybe some doctors, but the majority of people could not care less about what they're doing as a job as long as they're making a lot of money from it. I don't think indigenous people ever had anything like that. And so it's a completely different mindset. It's a completely different mindset. Indigenous people didn't have to go around worrying about looking out for number one. They could worry about looking out for each other and for Mother Earth and stuff. So the difference between indigenous and civilized is it's not in the color of your skin. It's not really in where you're from. It's how you're living. And so my big question is, how possible is it in the world of today for anybody to be truly indigenous? And I keep using the example of there being, say, for example, tribes way back up in Papua New Guinea or down in the Amazon or up in the mountains in the Andes or the Himalaya, you know, really, really extremely remote places where modern civilization may not have ever set foot. Maybe these people haven't ever even been seen or contacted by outside civilization. But even if anybody like this still exists, they would certainly know. They would know about us, either through having information shared with them by other people or their direct ability to sense and kind of know and feel what's going on. And maybe even if they didn't, now we're kind of getting into the territory of how I was describing how the pilot whales might have responded to the stimuli that resulted in their stranding. They could sense distortions or disruptions in, for example, atmospheric processes, in energy flows and currents of electromagnetic energy that flow, and sounds, and all different kind of things like this that they're constantly tuning into and reading and sort of calibrating themselves by. Whether they're consciously aware that they're doing this or not is really secondary to the fact that they might be doing it. Yet we, as humans, ascribe tantamount importance to self-awareness and being aware, but it's possible to do all the stuff we do and even be yourself to other people and yet not really be aware that you're doing it. And I'm not talking about being blacked out like somebody that drank too much alcohol. Now that's a mysterious phenomenon that I have personally witnessed in a friend of mine. You couldn't tell. I mean, you could sort of tell he was a little blacked out, but he could do everything, but the next day he couldn't remember anything after a certain time. And I'm like, well, how is that possible? So I think that we might be doing a lot of stuff, and the whales and dolphins and all life forms, that we aren't really aware that we're doing, but we might sense disruptions in these sort of the age-old patterns. And that alone might tell uncontacted indigenous people, for example, about some kind of presence, some kind of influence, a malevolent, pernicious influence in on the earth that's creating these kinds of effects, these ripples, these waves of incoherent distortion. So they would feel our presence, even if they might not know exactly who and what we were, but they probably know. But see, but I think that that's also what the pilot whales were having their hard time getting their head around, and what I've been trying to help them to understand is that there's all this weird stuff that they felt was attacking them. They thought it was a giant multi-tentacled monster coming at them from many, many, many different directions. But for them to realize that monster is actually us, it's stuff we've created that's doing all those bad things. And that alone, that would be enough to break their heart, because they would go like, but you're our friends from millions of years ago. Why did you do that? Why did you make those things that make all those noises and blow us up, destroy us, and scare us? And why are you doing that? And we thought you were our friends. And I think that's kind of where we're at with the whales and dolphins. They're mystified by what we're doing, as if we weren't. You know, and it's even more complex because the military-industrial complex wasn't created by me, wasn't created by you, and probably, hopefully, nobody you know has ever been involved in anything military, weapons systems and all this stuff. Yet, on the other hand, all of us support it, all of us pay for it, all of us are complicit in its existence, by just the fact that we're here now and we haven't even put our own lives on the line to try to shut it down. So this is one of the paradoxes of being here. And so even if somebody wanted to be indigenous in the world of today, I don't think that somebody driving around in a ute with a smartphone can really be indigenous. I mean, you can still have those things and maintain your sacred ceremonies and your rituals and traverse your song lines and sing your songs and do your paintings and stuff. And I think that this is how the reality is, like here in Northern Australia. And like me myself, I do a lot of that kind of thing, not from any specific indigenous tradition, but kind of like from a hybridized, synthesized configuration, honoring all spiritual and cultural traditions. But I use my computer. I'm recording the show on my video camera right now. I'm driving around in my friend's Land Cruiser. I'm staying at a house that's got electricity. And so, but I know what it's like to live on a remote island of Tasmania for over 4 months with no electricity. And sure, we were eating food that we bought from the store. Well, we grew a lot, but, you know, so it's a hybridized existence. I think that's probably the best word to describe all this is maybe hybridigenous. How about that? I thought before that cividigenous might be good, but hybridigenous is actually better, because that sort of tells the story. It's like I'm not a biological hybrid, not yet, but behaviorally. So I was thinking, you know, what actually are other categories if you don't want to be indigenous or civilized, what are we? So I came up with some of the words might be, well, if you're in a place where you're not from, like me, I didn't grow up in Australia, so bureaucratically I'm a tourist, but I'm not a tourist in the sense of what it means to be a tourist to most people. I'm a traveler, a nomad. But then a lot of people that came from other places, when the original European people came here, they didn't come as travelers, they didn't come as visitors, they came as conquerors, explorers, sent here to claim this land for the crown. And then they sent missionaries, and then they sent convicts. So, a lot of indigenous people have experienced civilized behavior in the form of people that came to where they live, uninvited, and just foisted themselves and their culture onto the indigenous people, who, by and large, have either no weapons or inferior weapons, because they didn't need them. They didn't go around. They didn't have to defend themselves from evil, other aggressive civilized people. They didn't have to live in forts and city-states. They were able to live in interconnected communities and join together every few times here and have corroborees and stuff like that. And back to the sort of quote-unquote race thing again, it's sort of in the mentality that anybody that's indigenous are people of quote-unquote color, right? Isn't that how the thinking goes? Like, you know, do you have white indigenous people anywhere? No, you might have poor white people, but so it's kind of this stereotype that indigenous people are not Caucasian, and according to the Darwinian hierarchical belief system, they're inferior beings that need to be eugenicized out of existence. That's the true story of Darwinian relationship between the title of his book is On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. And so in that book or his next book, he openly advocated that the Negro people of Africa and the Aboriginal people of Australia should be completely eliminated because they were genetically inferior and were holding back the progress of the human race. And that's just diabolical blasphemy, because it's so much the opposite of the actual truth. The white man, who has chromalexia, can't even perceive his own color, and smegmalomania, he thinks he's the biggest cheese on the block, and macrophilia, obsessed with everything being as huge as possible. He's beset by mental illness and degeneration. But the white man thinks he's the overlord of the earth, and that he's superior, and that all the other people will need to be gotten rid of because they're oxygen thieves or wasted protoplasm. And really, it's us. It's the white man who's been the root of the problem all along. But that's not really what the show is about. It's about trying to create a level of equilibrium between indigenous and civilized, and to look at how all these different concepts are emphasizing the difference between us. Whereas what we really need to do is look at the similarities, at what we all have in common. We're all people. We're all breathing the same air. We're all walking on the same Mother Earth. We're all drinking the same water, eating the same food. In the world of today, we're all watching the same TV shows. And that kind of thing, but we all have the same DNA. We all, no matter what language we speak, we're still basically doing the same kind of things. Like taking care of your kids, making dinner, maybe painting some rocks or editing a movie or something like that. But all the things, I mean, even what birds and mammals and primates and marsupials do is essentially not that different. We eat and we poopy and we wee-wee and we have a sleep and we groom ourselves. And so all of the things that humans basically do are essentially biologically common with all other larger life forms. And so in the world of today, you don't really need to go around putting on face paint to make people think that you're indigenous. Because, I mean, you know, if you're going to go do a show at the shopping mall or something like that, fine. But it's not really necessary. Face paint and all that stuff is kind of, it's superficial. What makes more sense in the world of today is for all of us, whether you think you're indigenous or not, is to realize that we all need to be on a higher spiritual path than the one we're on now. We need to educate ourselves about the reality of being here now. Like, one of the things I'm involved in is that people as a whole don't have very much basic scientific background. But if there was indigenous elders, for example, who I might be able to get in touch with, who are still initiated elders carrying the ancient knowledge of, for example, dolphin and whale dreaming, I would love to make contact with them and to see how much of that they might be willing to share. Because even though I'm not a traditionally initiated person of any Aboriginal tribe, it's like I've sort of, I'm more generalized than that, and I've been trying to connect with wavelengths that all the different cultures and backgrounds might have in common, related to the things I was just talking about, like the fact that we all live on Mother Earth. Mother Earth is still in the same solar system she's always been in, with the same star, the same planets and comets and asteroids going around, the same set of variables and possibilities of cyclical phenomena that can happen. And I was talking with Barbara Randall, widow of Uncle Bob, who was one of the custodians of Uluru, about how might it not be time for the indigenous secret knowledge to be revealed, at least to people that can understand or benefit from it. Like, for example, this is all just hypothetical, what I'm about to say, but for example, if there was indigenous elders of a whale dreaming or dolphin dreaming clan that knew that their secret belief was that the dolphins knew when the next planetary catastrophe was going to be. Like, what if something like that exists? You know, and I would say, well, look, I already know that because the dolphins himself told me. So I'm not coming from any tradition. I've been making my own and trying to connect with everybody and distilling out the things that are important. But like in my travels around Australia and New Zealand, I've tried to connect with the elders and the indigenous people as much as possible. But there's so much bullshit you have to get through sometimes. All the stuff about people arguing with themselves and about who's indigenous and who's not, and can this person come there and speak, or can this person do that? And then there's the fraudulent ones that are supposedly indigenous people, and they're signing off on mining rights for their sacred territory. That kind of shit's going on all the time. And so, but what I've tried to do is to go to the elders as much as I can, but my main process has been to connect directly with the earth and land and life forms herself, you know, directly to the non-human archetypes and ancestors that are there, that have always been there. They are our ancestors. They are who gave birth and origin to us. And so, because there's so much befuddledness and obfuscation in the whole human psyche, that I've really found it much more beneficial and harmonious to just go directly to nature in general, and to try to communicate with people whenever I can. Like, and that's why I'm doing this radio show right now. But I am sort of a hybrid of indigenous and civilized, but I think a lot of it's in your mentality and in your heart, and what you're open to, what you're able to feel and listen to and respond to, what you care about, what your values are. And also, as you, it could be a form of like a developing special siddhis or powers or yoga exercises to develop in your life ways of being, whether it might be something that you're actually doing or something that you're thinking or asking or telling your own body and your energetic fields and mechanisms to create vibrations or force fields or something that, for example, that might enable you to function harmoniously in an environment for a while that's got a noticeable level of microwaves that you don't like, but you're able to sort of not tune it out and pretend like it's not there, but to sort of send out vibrations to deal with it that might either block it or transmute it or send it around you without going into you with the adverse effects. And I really feel like that my whole system has been doing stuff like that. But, you know, it's all in your mind. But if you feel good and everything's working and you've got great clarity of mind and energy and creativity and vitality and an open heart and stuff like that, I think that that's a really good sign that you're on the right path. But it disturbs me to see so many people in the world of today spending all their time. For example, a friend of mine on Facebook, a musician from England, he just sent a thing about his latest golf game. And I go, like, you know, one of my best friends in New Zealand plays golf one day a week. And sure, it's a great thing to do. It's kind of like more something for people that are retired. But I go, like, but look, what does it mean to be retired? And I could never retire. I'm not even going to tire, much less retire. Retire from what? Retire from doing the life of all the stupid shit that you hated? To me, there'll never be enough time to get all my creative work done and everything. And so, but everybody could be spending more time using their conscious mind share man hours to understand and map out what's really going on in the world, like understand humanity's relationship with the earth and how destructive we are. Going into detail, I could have 100 people working for me and tell them different stuff to go and research and then get back to me with what they found that would save me the time of doing it. So, but these people are, it's like they're obsessed with finding how many different kind of sports they can do to keep them, their mind from having to think of something serious. And so when I think of how many people just kind of sit around all day, they think it's all right to just be on Facebook, twiddling their thumbs and observing on the election and all this stuff like that. And I'm trying to, like, investigate what the Starlink satellites are doing, all the amount of debris falling into the ocean, the explosion of deep seabed mining that's going to be a new level of threat to all the life in the ocean, to map out what really happened with these pilot whales, to understand the long-standing beliefs and ideologies of the whale-dreaming people, to contact indigenous elders up here in the top end and try to be of service to them, and do all my artwork and record a bunch of music and work on editing my films. And I mean, I just don't have enough time to do all this stuff. So a beautiful magpie goose has just come and sat in the tree right above me. I mean, it's right above me. If it poopies, it'll fall on me. That's such a beautiful blessing. Anyway, I think that we have to all work together and realize that we can't go back to any old ways that existed here in Australia or anywhere. Even if we wanted to, it's physically impossible. We're living in a world saturated by synthetic radionuclides, by chemical toxicity, by food additives, by microwaves and radio transmissions and stuff. All this stuff is there. It's been there a long time, and it's getting more and more. And we can't get away from it, and it's affecting all of life. Wow, it's kookaburras. Wow, two kookaburras. They're sitting right above me. They're different from the ones you hear in Tasmania. That is such a blessing that they came right now. We've got to work together to create or remember all the abilities we have, our telepathic communication, our ability to know what's going on, our ability to know that we're kin with all of life, and that we're all made of water and DNA, and we're all descended from stone, and that our species is waging war on everybody else. And how we can attenuate this, because our family of life loves us, but they're confused. They don't, it's hard for them to believe or understand that it's us. We're the boogie monster that's running. We're the Wizard of Oz pulling the levers on that machine. But unlike the Wizard of Oz, who was just on a screen, we're actually creating real military industrial weapon systems that are out there destroying life everywhere. So I think we've got to team up, civilized and indigenous. We've got to forget about all the differences of what language group you're from, what culture you're from, what color your skin might be, and all work together and emphasize what we have in common, that we're all people. We've all got the ultimate technology. We're all the passengers and the crew of Mother Spaceship Earth, but we really need to be much less passengers and much more crew. So I really think that indigenous people are the crew and civilized people are the passengers or excess baggage. Lauren Isley, one of my favorite writers, has some very interesting comments on indigenous people and their connection with their environment, as if there's no distinction between themselves and where they live. And that they might use a stone as a tool, but they didn't pick it up and take it with them. They just like left it there. So they weren't attached to possessions. They were just at one. They didn't have to modify their environment to do what they needed. And so you've got this whole continuum of, say for example, primates. They don't use fire or cook. They just pick stuff and eat it. And that's fine. And they don't get tooth decay. They don't need dental floss. They probably don't get indigestion. And so any carnivore that eats meat doesn't cook it. So how is it that we, who biologically aren't that different, how is it that we started to use fire and we started to use weapons? And all this just to survive. I mean, how did that happen? And to me, like, we call this progress. We call the people, our ancestors, that maybe were able to eat raw food and use their hands and they didn't need tools or fire. Maybe not even clothes. They could swim in freezing water like the Yamana down in Patagonia. How is the fact that we started needing fire and clothes and to kill stuff and to wage war and then living cities, how can this actually be called an evolution to a higher level? To me, it's exactly the opposite. It's the descent into increasing materialism. It's the true path of what the Hindus call the Kali Yuga. It's a descent into material identity and to remember the true Garden of Eden, the true spirit of indigenous people, is this true, the human being, the people of the Golden Age, when we were able to hear and be in touch with all life forms and we didn't need clothes, we didn't need fire, we didn't need tools or weapons or houses. We could just lay down on the grass and look up and see the stars and go swimming in the water and hear the gurgling of the waves, and everybody was our family. And I think it's possible to regain that, and I can't think of a more beautiful or more powerful place for that to happening, for that to happen, as it actually seems to be the reality of where I find myself spiritually and psychologically when I'm in Darwin, and especially when I'm here at the Botanical Garden and out at my favorite places like East Point Reserve and Buffalo Creek and down to Litchfield National Park, where I have to go this week, and other sacred places in the top end with lots of running water and the indigenous elders and the rock art. I'm so blessed to be here. This is like, to me, near where I am here in Arnhem Land is the highest concentration of the truest remnant and the truest spirit of what it truly means to be indigenous on all of Mother Earth. I think there's more truly indigenous people close to here than anywhere else on all of Mother Earth. And that's why I think it's such a blessing for me to be here now, and why Australia is the most powerful place on the whole planet and the most beautiful, and why I try to be of service to her, and why she's taken such good care of me. Because as I told in an email to Peter Weir this week, that Auntie Millie Boyd told Stella Whelan that they believed that long, long, long time before there was black people in Australia, there was people that looked like her with blonde hair and blue eyes. And so Peter Weir came up with this concept in his 1977 film called The Last Wave, that there was these beings called the Mulkurul, M-U-L-K-U-R-U-L, who were beings that came from the east that might have had fair skin, who had unusual psychic powers. And so my main interest in communicating with Peter Weir is to ask him where he got that concept from. Is it real or did he make it up? And because I know that two of the other themes in that movie are real, that the Bundjalung elders, Auntie Millie Boyd, refused to live near the coast because she believed a tidal wave could come and wipe them out at any time. And that thing about there being fair-skinned people in Australia a long time before there was black people. And I feel a very deep resonance with that somehow. I'm not saying that I'm one of them or that I'm a Mulcarol or anything, but I do have some very, very freaky things happening in my life that's really, really cool. And I think we all need to seize the helm, seize the day, stop being deluded and having our mind share stolen by stuff like the election of POTUS, which is just, it's just like the Springer show crossed with the Super Bowl. That's all it is. It's the chicken wing. Not the West Wing, it's the chicken wing. Oh my God, I can't ridicule it enough. Anyway, I guess I better go see my other Boab trees in the Madagascar garden and go out to East Point and maybe have my swim in the ocean and say hello to Mr. Crocodile and love all you guys and live simply so that others may simply live.
Good day.